This information is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information with regard to the subject matter covered. It is offered with the understanding that the presenters are not engaged in rendering legal, accounting, or other professional services. If legal advice or other expert advice is required, the services of a competent professional should be sought.
Welcome to the El Paso Real Estate Investing and Real Estate Financial Planning Podcast. Learn all about investing in real estate in El Paso, Texas, with a combination of real estate financial planning and modeling with numbers specific to El Paso, plus syndicated, more generalized recordings of live and pre-recorded real estate investing classes, not all of them specific to El Paso. Be sure to stay tuned after the podcast for a message from our sponsors.
Well, good morning and welcome, everyone. I am your host, James Orr, and today we are going over more deal analysis. You know, there are some folks that believe that you should never buy an investment property, rental property specifically, unless you are buying it at a significant discount. Then there's another group of investors who believe it's okay to not get a discount if you're getting an amazing rental property at a fair price. In other words, if the economics of your rental property are compelling enough that you're willing to buy the property without getting a discount, that's okay. Other people are like, no, you never buy rental property without getting a huge discount. You always get a discount when you buy. That's a rule. You know, there's a famous saying from Warren Buffett, and I'm probably going to butcher the quote, but it's something like, I'd rather buy a wonderful company at a fair price than a fair company at a wonderful price. And he's talking about his decision, Warren Buffett's decision, to move toward buying quality over getting just a discount because you can get a discount. So today we're going to look at analyzing a deal where you are getting a discount so that you can see how you would do that and what it would look like and how to do it using the world's greatest real estate deal analysis spreadsheet when you do your deal analysis. So we'll cover this. If you haven't downloaded a copy of the world's greatest real estate deal analysis spreadsheet, you could do that by going to realestatefinancialplanner.com/spreadsheet. And there'll be a link on there in order to sign up for the Substack. And when you sign up for the Substack, it gets emailed to you automatically as part of your initial welcome email. And then, of course, as we make updates, which I just made a small update to the spreadsheet this morning for this class, then we will email out so that you get the newest version and any support materials we have about changes or improvements or tweaks we've made to the spreadsheet. So that's why we don't just allow you to download it and then disappear in case there's something wrong. I want to make sure we're able to give you the most up-to-date, most correct version in case things get corrected or we find unusual or kind of fringe cases, edge cases of things that need to be corrected. So let's walk through the deal analysis. So I just downloaded a copy of the spreadsheet and we're just going to put in here kind of like the property we're doing. So this is going to be like a class example, you name it, whatever you want here, but class example, buying at a discount. So we'll just do that in there. And then the after repaired value, is going to be the value of the property after you do all the work you need to do to it. On the property. So in this case, we're buying a property and we're getting it at a pretty significant discount. So the property is going to be worth, once everything is done, we're estimating the property is going to be worth about $355,000. Now, how do you determine that? You need to get comps. You need to determine what the comparables are for the property after everything that you plan on doing to the property has been completed. Okay. So you have to do like there's a special name for this. It's an appraisal. What is the name of it? The name is eluding me, but it's a special type of appraisal where we're determining the value once things are done. But you can also just call your real estate agent or do your own comps to determine what the property will likely be worth if you do these particular fix-ups on the property. And so we can go do that. Oh, I think it's called a subject to appraisal, subject to certain work being done. Okay, anyway, so the after repaired value, in this case, we're assuming the property is going to be worth $355,000. And this property has been lingering on the market for some time, and the sellers are looking motivated, and it is not showing well, and it says some language in there that's motivated, and the agent who is representing the seller has suggested that they are definitely open to some offers. It is not listed for $355. It's listed for significantly below that, but we're going to even come in lower, and we managed to get the seller to agree to accept $300,000 as a purchase price. So we think once we do all this work on the property, it's going to be worth $355, and there's going to be some considerable work that needs to be done. We'll talk about that here in a second, but we're able to purchase the property for $300,000. So squint really hard. This isn't exactly 20% off, but you know, it's $55,000 discounted from the after repaired value. Now, there's some interesting things that are going on here. Number one is that's not all profit, right? There's going to be money that we need to spend in order to capture some equity. And so we're going to talk about that here when we talk about the rent ready costs and how much we need to put into the deal in order to make the property worth $355. But we are buying it at a discount. We're getting it for $55,000 below what we think the property is going to be worth. But some of that money we're going to actually pay in terms of rent ready costs in order to get the property to be worth $355. Okay. And because we got this huge discount, you know, this $55,000 discount on a $355,000 property after everything's done, the seller concessions, we're not able to negotiate those. So we're going to put zero. Seller concessions are additional money that the seller is willing to contribute towards your closing costs in order to get the deal done. Instead of giving you seller concessions, the seller gave you a discount. We were able to get $55,000 off the value of the property, if you think about it that way, although it's not off of list price. But $55,000 off of the value of the property, we're not able to also get the seller to agree to seller concessions. You know, in most cases, you're either going to get the discount or you're going to get seller concessions. It's rare for you to be able to negotiate both. And really, the discount you got is the sum of both those anyway, if you think about it in terms of like what you really got in terms of value. Okay, so seller concession is going to be zero. In this case, you know, normally a lot of times we have the placeholder be 25%. In this case, because we're going to need to put a lot more money into the deal in terms of repairs, we're going to decide to put only 20% down. Now, the total amount invested, if we had put, you know, 25% down and we were able to buy it for this without putting any rent ready costs there, would be about $81,000. But right now we're going to use this, we're going to move it to 20% down. So we're going to put down 20% of the $300,000 of the purchase price, not of the after repaired value. And specifically, I want to point out here, this is not a BRRRR deal, a property where you're buying it, you're rehabbing it, you're renting it out, and then you're trying to do some type of refinance in order to change the terms of the financing, maybe even pull some money out of the deal. That is not what we're doing here. In this particular example of deal analysis, we'll do BRRRR another time, but in this particular case of deal analysis, we're just assuming you're putting in your permanent financing when you acquire the property, and you're taking your own cash to do the fix up to just capture some equity when you buy the property. So you're buying it at a discount. You're getting the permanent long-term financing on the property when you do that, but you're going to bring in some money to make the property rent ready, to bring up the value, to kind of capture some sweat equity. And then we're not doing an immediate rate and term refinance or an immediate cash out refinance. So this is not a BRRRR deal. We will do a deal analysis class. We talk about how to analyze a BRRRR deal. Today is just buying the property at a discount, putting in the long-term financing from the beginning. Okay, so down payment, 20%. Closing costs were estimated to be about 1%. You'd call up your lender, you'd get that, and you'd adjust that there. Now, rent-ready costs. Now, normally, any rental property you buy needs something done. You know, when you have your inspection done, when you go to acquire a property, there's always a list of, you know, small deferred maintenance type items that a seller has, you know, not done and that you probably should do before you put a tenant in the property. And so usually we have some small number in here, you know, a few $1,000s, $3,000, I think is completely reasonable for a lot of cases. The rougher the property, the more deferred maintenance there is, the higher this number will probably be on your property. In this case, though, it's more than just the little deferred maintenance things of like fixing things that are like broken and stuff. This is a property. The reason why it's been lingering on the market, the reason why it wasn't selling is it's in relatively rough shape. You know, it needs stuff. It needs like work on the property. And so you're estimating, you know, somewhere between $20,000 and $30,000 in repairs that this property needs in order to be rent ready, in order for you to capture that money. So, and the $20,000 is you doing some of the labor. It's you being handy and kind of using, you know, your own hours. If it's closer to the $30,000 based on your estimates, and who knows what it will really be, because a lot of times we go in there and we think that, you know, it's only $20,000 and it's $25,000, and that's with us doing our own labor. It just turns out that, you know, there were some things we couldn't see or some things we didn't know, and prices were more expensive, you know. So, you know, it definitely happens that these are estimates and that they're not valid. You can come back in after you get real numbers, put it in there, and then see how your deal is doing sort of like after the fact. But most times when we're doing deal analysis, we are doing pro forma. We're analyzing things in advance of knowing what the actual numbers are going to be. We try to get as accurate as we can, and sometimes we even pad them a little bit in order to say, look, you know, we think it's really going to be 20, so I'll put in here, you know, 23,000 as kind of like give myself a little tiny buffer. And that's probably not a huge buffer. It's probably for someone who's pretty experienced, but I digress. So in this case, though, we are estimating what the repairs are going to be, and this is you doing your labor, which brings me to another discussion. So how do you count the fact that you're going to spend, I don't know, you know, 300 hours doing work on this property over the next month or two or whatever it is? How do you actually take that into account when you're thinking about, you know, your deal analysis? How do we account for that and when we're doing that? And you could choose not to. You could choose to say, hey, look, it's just part of my acquisition of the deal and I'm not going to count it. I'm not going to put it on there. But I think some folks would actually put in, you know, an arbitrary amount for their time. Like, what is their time worth? You know, is it like a, you know, $45 an hour sort of like wage that you want to earn for doing this? Because that's what a handyman might cost you to do it. Or are you going to get like a really inexpensive, you know, handymans, you're using them for a lot of hours and you're able to get them for, you know, $25 an hour or $20 an hour or whatever you're able to negotiate there. You know, what do you put in here for your own labor? So some people will choose to include their own number, their own kind of value of stuff in here, even though it's not a hard cost as part of the rent ready cost. So if you're that type of person, maybe you put in, you know, $25,000 or, you know, $30,000 or whatever it is here in order to get a more accurate idea. For me, I'm going to actually choose to say, look, this is around 23. I'm going to actually put $25,000. I'm going to use $25,000. And that'll give me a little bit of leeway in order to estimate like what the actual repairs are going to be on this thing when we're doing it. So for rent ready costs, we're going to say it's 25. Now, What's going on here is this. We're buying the property for $300,000, but it's taking $25,000. But by doing that, we've now captured $30,000 in equity, right? We bought it for $300,000. We had to put in, you know, of the $300,000, we had to put 20% down in order to acquire the property, plus 1% in closing costs, plus some reserves and stuff like that. But now we've got this additional $25,000 that we need in order to fund the deal. We need to come up with that money. Like in order to do it, it's not like we're going to be able to go and borrow that as part of the acquisition. This is money that is just like down payment. We need to actually use it to do it. And some people are like, you know, I'm going to go use my, you know, Home Depot or Lowe's or other big box store credit card, and I'm going to finance most of the hard costs of doing this. So it's not really like I need to come up with the money. I'm going to pay for this out of sort of cash flow, or I'm going to, like, you know, the money I was going to save up for down payments, I'm going to use that to kind of pay down the credit card on the from, you know, financing all the purchases of the supplies and everything I need. So yes, I understand that you might be doing that, but for the most part, though, you need to have this money come from somewhere in order to acquire the deal as we're analyzing it. So that's the specific situation we're talking about here. Another thing that's going to come up is some people are going to say, look, you know, I'm not going to be renting this property for the first month or two or three while I'm doing all the rehab on this property in order to get it ready to go. And what I would recommend you do is you buffer this rent-ready cost with a few months worth of your expenses for holding the property. And that is just the cost of acquisition. We don't necessarily go and try to change the rents or anything like that to kind of mess with that. But what we do say is, look, you know, the mortgage payment on this thing is going to be, you know, we'll go calculate that over here on the other sheet. But the mortgage payments on this is going to be whatever it is, $1,500 a month, $2,000 a month. And so we're going to have it for another 3 months. So, you know, it's going to be another $6,000 that we're going to need to set aside for all the expenses of kind of like holding the property. And you can add that to your rent-ready cost as an expense of acquiring the deal, and as an expense of the time it takes you in order to get the property ready to go. And then you're sort of assuming that your rental period is starting like 3 months from now when you're actually getting rent on the property. And then, of course, you can adjust with the overrides after the fact when you're looking back and say, okay, in year one, this is what I actually got in rent. This is what I actually had in expenses. And it will redo that. But looking forward, we usually do it just by estimating. Okay, so I put it back to $25,000, although you could put in here, you know, your estimate for rents and so on. Maybe I'll bump it up to 30. Okay, so now it's $30,000 in rent-ready costs, all the money you're going to need, including the holding costs for holding the property. And we're going to be able to capture now about $25,000 in true discount once we take into account the amount of money we need to do that. Based on this, because we're putting 20% down, interest rates are going to be a little bit higher. We're going to use 7%. You know, call up your lender and get your actual interest rate. They'll tell you what it is. We're going to do a 30-year loan. Because we're putting at least 20% down, there's no private mortgage insurance, so that's going to be zero. Basically, when PMI drops off, is not going to be in existence, so we're going to have it be 80. It doesn't really matter what we put here because it's not going to factor in. The rent we're estimating on this particular property, $26.95. Use whatever rents you are going to be able to get once the property has been fixed up and it's ready to go. So it's in, you know, primo shape after you put in, you know, $25,000 in upgrades and repairs on this property, and it's ready to go there. You're not going to get any other income on this property. That would be like if you're collecting money for extra storage units or, you know, something else. Vacancy rate, we're going to use 3% here because we're going to be starting 60 days in advance of at least 60 days in advance of the lease expiring to find the next tenant. So we should have very minimal vacancy, except in the rare case of a tenant who is, you know, unable to pay rent. And we're going to handle that pretty properly as well. As some new regulations change, because there's some pressure we're hearing around the United States about changes in local laws and stuff, this number may go up. Even though we're doing the right property management stuff, they may be able to stay in the property longer in situations where they're unable to pay the rent and evictions are taking longer and are becoming more expensive. And so those numbers may change as we do that. So be aware that vacancy rate may change a little bit over time. We may need to kind of increase that number to counteract some of the new regulations and legislation that we're seeing. Property taxes, use whatever property taxes you're seeing on the property. Although realize that if you come in and you do upgrades to a property, that may actually increase your property taxes. And so you may want to estimate what the new property taxes will be, provided the value. It's basing it on the value there anyway, but you can kind of see what it is. Property insurance, go call up your insurance agent, get a quote for that or estimate it based on some other ones you've gotten in the past. HOA dues, we're assuming it's $350 per year in HOA dues. Utilities, the tenant's going to pay all the utilities. There's no other expenses. You know, I had a real estate investor guy reach out to me the other day, and he was asking me, you know, I wish we had more spots in here for listing different expenses. I'm like, what other expenses are you talking about? And he had asked me about, you know, like, what about like LLC stuff and accounting stuff? I'm like, yeah, put that into other expenses. If you actually are going to pay a CPA to do your taxes, yep, I pay a CPA to do my taxes. It's an expense of the property. And so you could put that in here as an expense. If you're going to hire an attorney to put your properties to LLCs and there's cost of maintaining the LLCs each year and, you know, different things related to that, you could lump all those together and put that into an additional expense for this. And then if you have another additional expense like snow removal or lawn care or, you know, pest control or whatever else you're doing on here, you can put those in here as other expenses on a property. Most of the time, like regular pest control, like, you know, they have the guy come and spray for whatever it is, the little creepy crawly guys or do whatever you're doing there, that would be normally included in your maintenance. The spreadsheet is not intended for you to go and like list out every individual expense you have on your property and then kind of like have a separate line item for those. You aggregate those together and you say, look, that's, you know, these numbers are part of maintenance. These numbers are part of CapEx, which you've got separate spots in here for each of those. And they kind of work a little bit differently. So you could do whether it's more of a percent number or more of a dollar number, and you can kind of use those differently. If you've got utilities, we kind of separate that out. HOA, we separate that out. Taxes, insurance, we separate all that stuff out. Vacancy, we separate that out. And then I give you two additional fields for expenses. And most of the time, you don't need to use two. You kind of just group them together as other expenses, miscellaneous, and dump it in there. And then you have in your regular bookkeeping program, which is totally different than a deal analysis spreadsheet, that's where you actually can see a breakdown of all the different other miscellaneous expenses you've got in a property. If there is something that you think, hey, look, James, you're really missing the boat on this. We've been doing these deal analysis spreadsheets since 2003, maybe? 2003 is when we have Sasquatch. Sasquatch was the name of my first spreadsheet. The reason why it was called Sasquatch, it was often talked about, but seldom revealed. It was seldom seen by people because it was overwhelming. I mean, you think that, hey, look, you know, you just add more complexity to the spreadsheet and that makes it better. Honestly, what makes it better is reducing it down so that it's as simple as possible, but still really effective. And so this became the process of making the world's greatest real estate deal analysis spreadsheet, this version, which is kind of a derivative of Sasquatch, is that this is simplified. we tried to make it really easy on the homepage, and then we gave you the ability to do all the crazy stuff in the override section. That's where all the complexity is kind of hidden behind the, under the hood. But I digress. I don't even know why I'm telling you this. Oh, I think I'm telling you this because it's, the reason why we're trying to do this is to minimize the number of fields in here, minimize the expenses, and try to simplify it down for you to do that. Okay. So no other expenses. Maintenance on the property, we're estimating 10% of gross rents. If you're buying an older property, maintenance is probably going to be higher. If you're buying a newer property, maintenance could be a little bit lower. Really, where you want to get the combination of your maintenance and your capital expense numbers from is our capital expense spreadsheet. The capital expense spreadsheet, and I don't have a copy of it, I'd kind of pull it up here. The capital expense spreadsheet, we've got two different versions. We've got a basic version, and we have an advanced version. The basic version is just you list out all of the different capital improvements you're going to need to make in your property over time. Air conditioning, heating unit, roof, windows, kitchen upgrade, like anything that is something that will degrade on the property over time and at some point you will need to replace. Those are sort of like the capital expenses. Then we put in how much they cost in today's dollars and how frequently we will need to replace them. Whether that's, 5 years in the future, we need to do a roof every, whatever it is, near marketplace, 20 years in some places, a little bit less in others, a little bit more in other places. How often do you replace the AC unit? How often do you replace the hot water or the water heater? How often do you replace all these different components and what their cost is? And the spreadsheet will then tell you, okay, look, based on all of these expenses, you should be setting aside this dollar amount each month or each year, in order to have this money set aside so that you are likely to be able to handle it. The basic version of the spreadsheet assumes that everything is brand new and that you're starting at the beginning of the life cycle on everything you're buying. So, your roof is going to be due 20 years from now. Your hot water heater is going to be due 8 years from now. Your, furnace is going to be due whatever it is, 10 years from now. So the basic spreadsheet, the basic capital expense spreadsheet, assumes everything is starting at the very beginning. The advanced version allows you to say, look, this roof is now 10 years old because it's a 10-year-old property, which means that we just replaced the hot water heater or the water heater, 2 years ago. By the way, the side note about the water heater is, some people say that it's not a hot water heater because you don't heat hot water, right? And so it is a water heater that puts out hot water. So I try to correct myself, but I usually just call it the hot water heater. But I'm aware that there is a difference and that some people, they take umbrage with that. I digress. So the advanced version of the spreadsheet allows you to adjust how old the things are because that could significantly impact how much you should be saving. For example, if you think you have 20 years to save for a roof, you basically take the cost of a roof today, we adjust for inflation, and we say, we need to save, 1/20th of that per year in order to get to the point where we're going to have that money at that time. However, that's not true. If, imagine you're 15 years into the life of the roof and you only got 5 years now left to save up for the cost of a roof. Well, that changes how much money you should be setting aside for a roof. Now you got 5 years in order to save up the full cost of a roof. And maybe you only have 2 years to save up for the cost of a water heater and, 3 more years to save up for the cost of a furnace or whatever it is. And so the advanced version allows you to model that and to say, look, based on the cost of everything now, the inflation rate for all these different things, and you can adjust those, I think, in the advanced one, and how old they are and like how much money you're starting with. So you put in like, hey, look, I'll set aside, $12,000 because I know I've got a whole bunch of deferred maintenance coming up. So I'm going to start my account with 12K. Then it will actually show you how much you need to save per month in order to make sure you don't run out of money budgeting for capital expenses. So the reason I went through all of this stuff about the capital expenses is you need to go look at that spreadsheet to find out what your maintenance number should be and what your CapEx number should be here. And a combination of both of these should save up to cover all of your capital expenses. Some of the ongoing maintenance and some of the CapEx, depending on what you're doing in a spreadsheet. All right, enough of that tangent. In this case, we're having a professional property manager. The property manager is charging 10% of gross rents, and so we got that number in there. We're estimating that the value of the land is 15% of the purchase price. That's what we're estimating. So about $45,000 is the value of the land. And the property type, it's residential. So we're estimating that 27.5 years is the period for depreciation. And then the effective income tax rate, we use that to calculate what the depreciation, cash flow from depreciation is on the property. So when we do that as part of the return. Okay, so I've got these numbers in here. I want to point out something else, though. We need to make one more change. And this is where we're going to go to the overrides tab. Because if you look over here at returns, it looks like the appreciation we earned in that first year, it looks like it's $65,650, which it's not, right? It thinks that we bought the property for $300 and that it's now, it was worth $355 when we bought it, plus 3% is, you know, going to be $65,000, another $10,000 or so. So it thinks that the property value went up, you know, $65,000 from when we bought it. But that's really not true, right? It didn't just go up $65,000. You know, $10,000 of it was actual organic appreciation, but, you know, $55,000 of it minus the money we had to spend in order to get the forced appreciation, the kind of like appreciation we got by doing the fix up, the sweat equity part of the appreciation, that needs to be subtracted out because it really wasn't $55,000 in that. It was really $55,000 minus the $30,000 we had to spend in order to be able to get that money. Okay. So we need to override that number. And so we go to the overrides tab, and here at the top, there's a section about property value and the thing. And so, oops, where am I going here? There we go. I somehow clicked the button and went to the end. All right. So now we're up here and we're looking at the ARV at the end of the year. So basically it's telling you that, hey, look, it was going to be $355 when we bought it, but a year from now, it's going to be $365,650. And that's using a 3% appreciation rate on the property. Okay. Now the appreciation dollar. So it thinks that it went from $300,000, which is what we purchased to now this $365,650. But that's not right. In fact, we need to actually override this and say, look, it didn't actually go up that amount. It really only went up, you know, the difference between this $65,650 minus $30,000. So we can even do a formula in here, $65,650 minus $30,000, because that's how much we spent. And so it'll actually show you the amount of appreciation we really saw. Some of it was forced appreciation from us buying at a discount and doing some work and putting some money in the deal. And some of it was organic appreciation, the property value going up. And really in that first year, it was $35,000 that we saw in appreciation. Now, when we go back to this tab, it adjusted this number down to a more reasonable number. It's still huge. The return we earned by buying a property discount was massive in that first year, but it's not the $65,000 that we thought it was because it really wasn't $65,000. It was really $65,000 minus the $30,000 we spent because that was an expense in order to capture some of that. Okay. That's why we do it that way. All right. So just looking at this deal quickly, I'm not going to go through all these things. I've done that in previous deal analysis classes, but I will show you, you know, this one's cash flowing at $183 a month. And I added these sum totals because sometimes it was harder to read just on the charts and I want to make your life easier. And so we just listed some of these totals down here, rather than you have to go read the chart. So monthly cash flow is $183, which is the same number here. The cash flow from depreciation, that's the cash flow you're getting from those tax benefits of owning the property. That's $155 a month. And so the total true cash flow, which is really the monthly cash flow plus that cash flow from depreciation, is $338 per month. So decent amount of cash flow on the property. The total return in dollars from each of the four areas of this right up here, from appreciation, cash flow, paying down the debt, and the cash flow from depreciation, the tax benefits, is $42,140 in that first year. But remember, $35,000 of that was that appreciation. So a huge part of it was the fact that you bought the property at a discount, and it won't look like this in year two, right? Because year two numbers are going to look very different than this. In fact, if we go to the overrides, you can look at the year two numbers. We'll just scroll down and look at the return in dollars quadrant in year two. We're only seeing $10,000 in appreciation, $2,839 in cash flow, $2,614 in debt pay down, and $1,855 in cash flow from depreciation for a total return of $18,277, which is a lot less than the $42,140 that we saw before in year one. Okay, because so much of it was from that appreciation. That massive amount of appreciation we saw, the forced appreciation from year one. Now, the total return in dollar quadrant plus 6 months of reserves, the reserves adds another $292 there. And the reserves for doing 12 months of reserves at a higher rate of return gives you $2,334. So that gives you $44,473. So this shows you your number if you're ignoring reserves. This shows you the number if you have 6 months of reserves at 1%. And this shows you if you have 12 months of reserves at 8%. what the actual dollar amount of return is in the first year. Okay. Then we take each one of these numbers and we divide through by the total amount invested in order to do the deal, including your reserves in one of the cases. So this shows you the total amount invested here, right? Is that number right here, 93,000. So we take this number divided by that 93,000, should get this 45.31. And you can see that you're getting a 45.31% return on your money if we ignore reserves. This is you going to a cocktail party and lying to your friends about what your return is on the property, because it tends to be the best one. And it tends to be the most simple one. So one that people probably expect and understand, because most people are not going to expect that you're analyzing your properties correctly by taking reserves into account when you're determining your return on your investment. Because you should have your reserves as part of your denominator when you're calculating how much you're getting on your amount that you invested. Got to have the down payments, got to have your closing costs, got to have whatever you had to spend in order to acquire the deal, this $30,000 in rent-ready costs. If you had any negative cash flow, we'd add that to it as well, but in this case, you don't. And so that total amount invested is $93,000. In addition, you need reserves, okay? And so this one is the one without reserves, 45.31. However, if we do 6 months of reserves, it's 39.44. And if we do 12 months of reserves, it's 36.40. So if you're analyzing your deals, you're taking into account reserves, your return in that first year is 39.44%. If you're doing 12 months of reserves, it's 36.40. And with a large percentage of it is this blue appreciation number, because a lot of what your return is right now is going to be from appreciation. Okay. And then you could see, you know, the returns have sold. There's a big bump up after year one. Kind of you can see all those things. It shows you your cash on cash return on investment numbers and your cap rate numbers on this particular property. And this shows you your return on true net equity. Well, if we're looking at year one, we have this massive amount of appreciation return, but then it goes down to a much more normal kind of like steady state number for year two and on. And you can see that adjusted there. Okay. So you can look at the other numbers as well. But that's really what I want to point out to you about like how your returns look and whether, you know, when you analyze a deal, like the adjustments you need to make for buying a property. This, I'll mention one other side comment right before I end here. And that is a lot of people are obsessed with cash flow. You know, they believe that cash flow is the, you know, the key to doing this real estate investing thing. And for some folks, depending on your goal and your kind of like path to get to your goal, that can definitely be true. There are other ways to do it. I mean, there's other strategies to kind of achieve financial independence where you're not relying on cash flow specifically. You know, I did a whole class, cash flow versus appreciation, where I walk through two different, you know, prototypical people, one who's in a market where they can't really get cash flow, but they got good appreciation, you know, 3% per year type appreciation. And then I got another market where they don't have really good appreciation, but they got great cash flow. And I can show you how both of them can achieve financial independence, you know, depending on the strategy you use in that marketplace. So most people, though, are obsessed with this cash flow number. And one of the things that's interesting about being able to buy properties at a discount is you could, it's a mathematical thing. It's sort of like allocating money. So there's no like actual implementation of this, but you could think of, hey, look, I'm going to buy this property at a discount and I'm going to take part of the discount that I'm getting when I'm going to acquire the property. And I'm going to pull money out of my pocket and I'm going to use that in quote discount that I got, even though I'm not using the discount directly, taking money out of my pocket that is reflected in the discount that I got. So I'm giving up some of my discount by taking cash that I already have set aside somewhere else. And I can use that to buy down my interest rate. So the thinking about it, it's almost like a thought process, a thinking tool of, I can use the discount I'm getting on my properties to then improve cash flow even more than just, you know, having a lower mortgage balance when I acquire the property. So in other words, in this case, let's say you had, you know, what did we say it was like $35,000, $25,000. So you got $25,000 in discount when you bought this property. Well, you could take part of that. You could take, you know, 10 grand or whatever it is. Add that to the amount that you put more into the deal. So probably add it to like a rent ready cost as an expense, or actually it's technically closing cost. You add it to the closing cost. And then you could use that to go to your lender and buy down your interest rate to improve cash flow. So you're taking money that you sort of gained when you acquired the property at a discount, and you use that in order to buy down your interest rate in order to improve cash flow on a property, because that is, based on what you're telling me, is your preferred quadrant for your returns. You really want cash flow. That's what you've told me. And if you're willing to do that, then that is one way to convert the discount, the proceeds, the forced appreciation proceeds you've gotten by buying a property at a discount into better improved cash flow. Okay. You still need the money on the sideline. You know, you're not going to, this doesn't magically come out of the property, but it's sort of like a bookkeeping entry of, okay, well, you know, when I bought this property, I had, you know, what, just make up a number, $50,000 in equity in the property by buying this at a big discount. Well, I'm going to take $10,000, $15,000 of that, and I'm going to use that money in order to buy down the interest rate. And you're really just taking money out of your pocket and you're using it, but realizing that you've captured that in equity in the property and that you're going to get it back when you eventually sell the property or do a cash out refinance later. So you're sort of just using money you already have, but it's money that really exists inside the deal. You're putting more equity into the deal. It's another way of thinking about that by buying into a lower interest rate. All right, that's all I got to say about that. This has been James Orr. Hope you've enjoyed the class on deal analysis. Have a great day, everybody. Bye-bye for now.
With home prices up, mortgage interest rates up, and rents up, but not quite enough to counteract the higher prices and interest rates, cash flow on rental properties in El Paso is harder than ever. Book a call with the Real Estate Financial Planner to apply our proprietary 88 strategies to improve cash flow on your rentals. See the show notes for a link to schedule your call and improve your cash flow today.
If you're a real estate agent, lender, or professional in El Paso that wants to help our real estate investor listeners, consider reaching out to learn about collaboration opportunities with this podcast. We'd love to add more value to our listeners by having you assist our investors buy, sell, and finance their real estate investment. See the show notes to schedule a call to discuss collaboration opportunities.